Communism in Germany, Part 7, The Armed Rising. A. Mobilization. The first chapter of the preparations for civil war is concerned with intelligence service, the employment of secret agents and spies, and with the building up of an illegal organization. These different activities are closely connected and are under one leadership. They aim at finding out about the enemy, discovering his plans, revealing his weak spots, at wearing him down and making him as incapable as possible of putting up a fight. The second chapter of the preparations for civil war is logically connected with the first and deals with positive work in the communist ranks themselves. It aims at setting up, against a weakened opponent, a strong, well-disciplined, well-organized, courageous, resolute, and finally well-armed Red Front. If things come to a crisis, and the day of armed rising approaches, the greatest emphasis is to be laid on procuring an adequate supply of arms and ammunition. Although the armed rising must always and everywhere be a mass action and must only give the enemy the final death blow, nevertheless, the result depends on the fighting, man to man, in the open street and on the barricades. At the last resort, the fate of the revolution depends on the terrorist group. Quote, "Now, revolution is an art, just like war and other arts, and is subject to certain rules. Any party which neglects these rules brings about its own destruction. The rules are logically deduced from the nature of parties and the circumstances of the particular case. They are so clear and simple that the short experience of 1848 has made them familiar to the Germans. Firstly, one should never play with the idea of a rising unless one is prepared to defy all the consequences. A rising implies reckoning with unknown factors, the value of which may change every day. The fighting forces to which one is opposed have the advantage of organization, discipline, and traditional authority entirely on their side. Unless strong forces are brought against them, one will be beaten and destroyed. Secondly, when once the rising has begun, one must act with the greatest determination and seize the offensive. The defensive means death to any armed revolt. It is lost before battle is joined. Surprise the enemy when his troops are dispersed. Try and get daily new, even though small, successes. Maintain the moral superiority which the first successful rising has given you. Bring all those elements over to your side who are at first uncertain, but who always follow the strongest, so that they cannot rally their forces against you. In short, in the words of Danton, the greatest known master of revolutionary tactics, boldness, boldness, and still more boldness." Close quote. The way to victory says further concerning the armed rising, and this is taken from this book called The Way to Victory, which is obviously a communist publication. Quote, "We do not believe in an unarmed, but in an armed rising. The most burning central question of the rising is the problem of arming the proletariat. The question of arms must be, in the first place, solved by the masses themselves, who must provide themselves with whatever weapons they can get a hold of." One could add indefinitely to Lenin's list of examples of primitive weapons available to the proletariat, to knives, knuckle dusters, rags soaked in petrol, etc. One could add, perhaps, axes, bricks, boiling water for pouring onto the bestial police raging in the working class quarters, simple hand grenades of dynamite, to mention only the most primitive of the almost infinite possibilities available everywhere for the arming of the proletariat. It is proletarians who work in chemical factories and in mines and have to handle poisonous gases and explosives, or who have to transport on the railways and waterways the bourgeoisie's instruments of murder, if, for the sake of their freedom, they make use of these possibilities given to them, they are only doing their duty. Close quote. Then, as Neuberg frankly says, quote, the armed rising to destroy the apparatus of government and to seize power for the proletariat takes the form of a ruthless armed struggle between the militarily organized part of the proletariat and its allies on the one hand, and the likewise militarily organized forces of the governing classes on the other hand. Close quote. Alfred Langer continually emphasizes that the proletariat must not wait until it is presented with weapons from some quarter or other. It must rather procure them itself in every conceivable way, by theft, robbery, and murder. The Communist Party in Germany acted according to these principles, apart from the delivery of arms from abroad, either by courier from the East or through smugglers from the West. The communist fighting and terrorist organizations procured all their weapons themselves. The theft of explosives and weapons was the favorite method of self-arming for the proletariat. The smuggling of weapons was a permanent branch of the KPD. On many occasions, the customs officials have been able to show that the KPD have tried to smuggle through weapons from Czechoslovakia, Belgium, or Holland. On April the 9th, 1932, a revolver with cartridges was found in the house of a worker in Marienburg, Saxony, together with other weapons of the same kind, all of which had been smuggled into Germany. On January the 20th, 1932, on the Belgian-Dutch frontier near Maaseik, the unemployed Herbert Rotter of Moers, Albert Forster of Meerbeek, and Robert Rukart of Moers were arrested by the Dutch police while attempting to smuggle weapons from Belgium into Holland, and 16 Belgian pistols and 115 cartridges were taken from them. The smugglers, who were all keen members of the KPD, admitted that the weapons were to be introduced through Holland into Germany. The president of the Hamburg Fiscal Office stated in a report at the beginning of 1932 that many weapons had been illegally introduced by sailors. Also, the president of police of Hamburg expressed the opinion that Russian ships were smuggling in arms. The miner, Robert Piltz of Aix-la-Chapelle, who was closely connected with the KPD, was sentenced in May 1932 to 7 months' imprisonment for smuggling arms. The frontier station of Liegnitz of the state police succeeded in March 1933 in arresting six communists in Seldenburg, Silesia, who, in alliance with Czechoslovakian communists, were bringing arms and literature from Czechoslovakia into Germany. The most important sources of arms and explosives were nevertheless the armament factories at home, the shops where weapons are sold, and the chemical concerns, all of which were systematically stolen by the fighting organizations of the KPD and their weapon procuring sections. One gets the best idea of what was going on from the extraordinarily numerous trials before the Supreme Court, which, in the years 1929 to 1930 alone, there were no less than 70 thefts of explosives that became known to the police. We cannot estimate how many undiscovered thefts of explosives and arms were successfully carried out. Fairly well known is the great trial before the Supreme Court of those accused of stealing in February 1933 from a Leipzig army depot one heavy machine gun, 36 light machine guns, and 217 rifles. The greater part of the accused, particularly P... and Metin, were given long sentences of imprisonment. The accused were nearly all members of the KPD, or closely allied to it. Only in the case of the army employee P was it impossible to prove this. Certain of the accused, such as Lindau, Weidemann, Thaler, and others, admitted in the preliminary examination that the weapons were to be procured for the party. One may take it, therefore, as proved that the theft took place at the instance of the KPD. In the case of the Thatcher, August Rahnmüller, and accomplices of Erfurt, the deliberate attempt to procure explosives and arms for the KPD was also proved. On January the 3rd, 1931, 52.5 kilos of ammonite were stolen in a most cunning way from the powder magazine of the chalk works in Opitz near Posnick in the Erfurt district, although the magazine was built into the rock and closed with three doors. During the trial, it was also revealed that in the period from the 9th to the 16th of January 1931, 7 packages, each containing 2.5 kilos of ammonite, 80 blasting cartridges, and 4 meters of fuse had been stolen from the locked magazine of the lime kiln owner Ludwig Fuldener near Exelben. On the 20th of February 1932, 33 military rifles converted into sporting rifles, 3 infantry rifles, 9 carbines with about 750S cartridges, 250 model, 88 cartridges, and a machine gun belt with about 250S cartridges were found in the summer hut of a certain Gross in Erfurt. The explosives from Opitz were conveyed to Berlin a short time after the theft. Several of the accused in February 1931 converted, or tried to convert, the stolen explosives into ammunition which could be used by them. We will now cite a particularly interesting trial which demonstrates all of this. Überbruck was arrested on the 23rd of October 1931 at the station in Berlin on his arrival from Breslau. He had with him 2 trunks filled with explosives. When his house was thereupon searched, considerable quantities of communist literature were found, as well as materials for making instruments, etc., for committing outrages, as for instance fuses, blasting cartridges, fuse cord, drawings of explosive ammunition and cartridges, hand grenades, hand grenade fuses, etc. The explosive which was discovered, chlorotite 3, had been stolen from the magazine of the firm of Sufmilch on the night from the 5th to the 6th of February 1931. The tin boxes discovered in Überbruck's house and made by him corresponded in size to the cross-section of a railway rail and therefore were particularly adapted to be fixed to a rail. In shape, they were in fact similar to what is used for blasting rails. A periodical was also found, entitled Strategy and Tactics of Civil War, Part 1, Partisans' Warfare, which dealt especially with the blowing up of rails. Überbruck confessed that he had belonged to a certain circle whose aims were political and included procuring and eventually using explosives. Rahnmüller was sentenced to 4 years penal servitude and 5 years loss of civil rights. Überbruck to 8 years penal servitude and 4 years loss of civil rights. In passing sentence, the Supreme Court stated, among other things, quote, "The extraordinary extent of Überbruck's activity in collecting and distributing explosives, over 1 CWT of explosives and about 3,000 blasting cartridges were found in his possession, in addition to other explosive material, and his defence that he and his companions were working for defence against fascist attacks, prove that Überbruck was determined to make use of the explosives accumulated by him at the next opportunity, or to allow his companions to use them, and thereby to endanger property, life and limb of others." It also proves that he and his accomplices, who brought him the explosives and sent him on his journeys, were conspiring by consultation and actual preparations to do this at a given moment. And further, it was not only at Bethmann's, that's one of the accused, instance, that an organisation was formed which directed from Berlin the preparations for arming with explosives, but this group had its centre in Berlin, but appealed for help in procuring weapons and explosives to other local groups of the KPD in many different places in the Reich. But the aim of the organisation, started and directed from Berlin, was not merely defence against the supposed threat of fascism. Berthmann's programme emphasises the intensification of the industrial crisis and the danger of the legal seizure of power by the National Socialists by way of a parliamentary majority, and indicates therefore that those about Berman were not to let the anticipated agitation of the masses at their ever-increasingly depressed condition go unexploited. On the other hand, they were resolved under all circumstances to impose their will by force on those of a different political complexion, even if the latter should have formed a constitutional government. Those who are preparing the way for the revolution have two tasks: to recruit soldiers of the revolution and to obtain weapons for the attack. Various pamphlets and leaflets published or approved and quoted from by the party leaders demand the fulfilment of the latter task. This coincidence of the theoretical discussion in the Oktoberhest, the military news of the Communist Party, and in lectures given to the local branches of the practical realisation by the accused, seems to be the reason why the defending counsel was more concerned to disprove any connection between the acts of the accused and the leaders of the KPD than to deal with what the accused themselves had actually done. The accused, Überbrück, had, on his arrival with the explosives in Berlin, been in possession of an identity card from the ZK secretary, Gutsch, and Überbrück had, on each of their journeys to Breslau to procure explosives, visited the district headquarters of the KPD. According to the accused, the explosives and weapons in Erfurt and Posnek had also been procured, not without the knowledge of the party officials. In the trial of Neumann and his accomplices, it was established that August Meyer, heavily implicated in this case also, had been the Wumbo, the official for procuring weapons and ammunition in the then existing partisan organisations for the chief district in Berlin, Brandenburg. Close quote. While the Überbrück case gives one a clear view of the political background to the thefts of explosives, the following more plainly shows what details of explosive technique were taken into consideration in such thefts. In the judgment passed on the taxi driver Clemens Schelinski of Hagen by the Supreme Court on January the 6th, 1933, the following passage occurs. Quote, "The expert, an artificer lieutenant, retired, named N, certified in the main proceedings that the explosive in the possession of the accused, Wagner, was a so-called Brisant explosive, that the instantaneous fuses were electric quick fuses being attached to aluminium ring blasting cartridges with double insulated wire. That is to say, they were explosives within the meaning of the Explosives Act. The court is satisfied that N's statement is correct. The examination of four samples of each had shown them to be ready for use. The cartridges, each containing 75 grams, are of the year 1932 and are therefore in extremely good condition. For any single explosion, they would be fully effective. The fuses from the Electric Fuse Works Limited Cologne factory in Troisdorf are each fitted with 2 4.5 meter double insulated tin plated copper wires and may therefore be used also underwater. The firmly fixed blasting cartridge, size number 10, is the most powerful of its kind. Chlorotite 3 is used for blasting in quarries, clay pits, potash works, and also for blasting underwater, together with the electric underwater quick fuse, bridges, traffic facilities on riverbanks, canal docks, canalization pipes, gas and water pipes, and so on, can be easily and unobtrusively blown up from a safe hiding place, but it can also be used to load and explode hand grenades, bombs, mines, etc., attached to a blasting cartridge of 75 grams of chlorotite 3. This explosive charge is equivalent to a heavy hand grenade or the shell of a light field gun. Even the layman would recognize without difficulty from the seal, chlorotite 3, the dangerous nature of the cartridges. Close quote. Now, I'll just interject here to say just how much this reminds me of what's going on in Syria at the moment, where they started off by saying that this was a peaceful protest and there was these protesters and it was an uprising against the evil dictator Bashar al-Assad, and they soon started shooting the police and shooting the security services, and after they'd done that they started blowing up railway lines and blowing up oil depots and power stations and switching the power off and the water off and attacking all the infrastructure. And in exactly the same way as while this was going on in Germany, the Soviet press was portraying it as an uprising, fighting against the bourgeoisie and democracy and all this sort of rubbish. They were doing that in Russia. We are getting the same here. This is what they're telling us about in Syria. It's the same thing that they're telling us about Syria. They're telling us that it's the people that are rebelling against Bashar al-Assad and they want democracy. But it's not. It's an armed uprising that's been funded by the same people that were funding this uprising in Germany, the Jewish banksters. It's funded by the same people. And it's not a genuine uprising at all. They are agents for a foreign power. They're agents for the Western banks that are in the control of the Jews. So the same thing is happening today as was happening here in Germany. So you can see that there's nothing new under the sun, basically. On account of the danger of transporting explosives of this nature, those persons who were to undertake it were most carefully picked in accordance with their reliability and courage. But even so, the transport often took place in a most careless way and seriously endangered the lives of those in the neighbourhood. The explosives were often carried simply in the hands or in the pocket or even hung between the legs. Weapons were also concealed in this way. In one case, a linen band was tied around the hips. To this, a second band was attached, which led through between the legs. To the second band, a cloth case containing a pistol was attached. Yes, this reminds me of these Negroes that shove the guns down their the waist of their tracksuit trousers and then end up shooting themselves in the leg. And it's not just the ghetto Negroes either. There was a black police officer who did it the other day in a lift, trying to impress his wife, I think he was. On the 27th of December, 1932, at 7:45 p.m., two police sergeants on their beat in Hamburg, St. Pauli, saw a red delivery van, HH41284, stop in front of the house, number 62, Bernhard Nacht Strasse. Three men unloaded a heavy case and carried it into the house, while a fourth remained behind in the car. The policeman challenged the men just as they were carrying the case into the cellar. Since they refused to answer questions as to the contents of the case, and why they were transporting it, one of the policemen opened it and found that it contained arms. An examination of the cellar into which the case was being carried revealed, among other things, 2 army pistols, 34 pistol cartridges, 1 pamphlet, The Way to Victory, by Alfred Langer, 3 communist leaflets with the Morse alphabet written by hand on the back, 18 unfilled collection lists of the Red Mass self-defence. By means of theft and smuggling, the KPD and its fighting organisations had, according to all appearances, provided themselves amply with explosives and weapons. At the end of the year 1932, there could be no question of an absence or scarcity of weapons, as had been the case in the Hamburg Rising of 1923. The Red Revolutionary Army was richly provided with the most deadly instruments of murder. Daggers, rubber truncheons, knuckle dusters, axes were an ordinary part of the equipment of the rank-and-file communist. In addition, every member of the fighting organisations proper and of the party was undoubtedly supplied with firearms and explosives, and the organisations themselves had in many parts of the country secret arms depots which could be used to fit out the terrorists on the day of the armed rising. It is obviously impossible to draw up a list of all the arms depots and munition dumps of the KPD in Germany. Here we can only judge from the evidence which has been given of the various cases of depots which have been discovered. In spite of much eagerness on the part of the people to report communist arms and explosive dumps, the general public has hardly any idea of the enormous quantity of weapons that were actually discovered. We will therefore give a few examples. In May 1932, while searching the house of the miner, Bayrovsky, in Buthen, who was said to have been a member of the Anti-Fascist League, the police found 50 dynamite bombs made out of 1-pound jam tins, 8 detonators, 28 dynamite blasting cartridges, 191 rounds of ammunition, 2 rifle locks, a machine gun case with oiled machine gun parts, 50 detonators with fuses, 10 pieces of insulated wire with detonators for electric detonation from a distance, 3 rolls of fuse, and a tin of dynamite. These objects were found in a cellar, access to which was through a trap door on which a sofa stood. In November 1932, the house and grounds of the communist town councillor Springer in Tilsit were searched, and in the grounds were found a pit, 50 centimetres deep, full of closed wine bottles. The bottles contained rifle ammunition. 4 communists who had, in the night of the 18th of August 1932, stolen £100 of ammoniac and £4 of powder from the explosive depot in the Daffenbach were condemned by the Court of Justice at Trier to sentences of 2 to 3 years imprisonment. In January 1933, as a result of searching the houses of 3 communists in Essen, 12 gas masks, 11 tear gas canisters, 4 packets of smoke powder, 3 pistols with ammunition, and subversive propaganda were found. The gas masks, tear gas canisters, and the powder had been stolen by one of the accused from his employer. The gas masks eventually found were 25 in number. The contents of one of the seized tear gas canisters would have been sufficient to put a whole department store, or in the open street, an entire police detachment out of action. 1 package of smoke powder would be enough to hide in fog an entire street procession. The accused were said already to have made experiments with the smoke powder in remote parts of the town at night. In February, a cigar shop was searched and the following objects were confiscated: 1 rifle, pattern 98, 5 pistols, 1 dummy pistol, 1 live egg hand grenade, and 600 rounds of pistol ammunition. Worthy of note is a find near Bottrop Recklinghausen in March 1933, of which the report states, "Here were found buried in the railway embankment a milk can with 40 tins made up as hand grenades, large quantities of detonite and Amon Sipeta, 6 egg hand grenades, a large sack with 66 tins filled with explosives, 12 short tubes for hand grenades, 1 zinc case with a pound box of detonite, a 10-centimetre shell with detonator, and 3 hand grenades." And there then follows a very long list of weapons confiscated from communists in 1932 and at the beginning of 1933. We will now give a short summary that shows that the KPD has taken to heart Lenin's teaching. Quote, "The bomb has ceased to be the weapon of the isolated bomb thrower. It secures the essential weapon for the arming of the people. The methods and instruments of street fighting must be modified in accordance with the change in the technique of war." Close quote. In considering the finds of weapons and explosives, one must remember that the KPD had already given very strict directions for removing weapons from the party restaurants, dwellings and offices. In transforming itself into an illegal and conspiratorial organisation, it was clear that weapons and explosives were the most important things they wished to hide safely. It is therefore quite certain that the police has, up to now, succeeded in finding only a very small portion of the communists' arms and ammunition which really exist. Even now, the greater part will be hidden in disused mines, in allotment gardens and woods, in the beds of canals and rivers, waiting for the day of the armed rising. The countless assaults and murders committed by the KPD on SA men and police officers prove conclusively that communism in Germany was an extremely determined armed force at war with the entire nation.